call the Public Safety Subcommittee to order. I'm going to reopen the hearing on Senate Bill 5515, which is the Dispute Resolution Commission. Mr. Niemeyer is here today to go over the final pieces and parts of their presentation. We got to hear part of their presentation last week. We've been on a pretty tight schedule, so go ahead, Mike.
Thank you, Chair Patridge, committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Niemeyer. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission. We're just wrapping up our presentation. Give you about 10 minutes here to finish up on the public policy dispute resolution component of our budget. I've got Dale Blanton here, who is the manager of that program, and he'll just give you a quick run-through of that.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Dale Blanton with the Public Policy Program. Also want to note that Chris Jarmer from the Oregon Forest Industry Council, who was not able to testify because of a conflict last Friday, is here if the committee wants to hear from Chris. As Mike and our commission chair last Thursday said, what we do is relatively simple, and I'll refer you to page 9 of the PowerPoint handout that you were going through last week. First of all, we help agencies and stakeholders. The first thing we do is help agencies and stakeholders resolve complex public policy disputes. The second thing we do is work with agencies to improve their dispute resolution systems. I want to talk a little bit just about statistics. During this biennium, we have worked on approximately 97 complex public policy cases. 52 of those proceeded to a convening, and given our track record, approximately 84% of the cases that convene will reach agreement. Our efforts have served 29 cities, 22 counties, 42 agencies, boards, or commissions, 38 interest groups, and countless citizens. At this point, we've leveraged approximately $550,000 in grants and other support from either federal agencies or other state agencies. Most of this goes to help pay for the actual work on cases that are convened. You've already heard from a number of stakeholders who I think made a much better argument than I can for the value of our work, but I'll just refresh your memory of a couple of the cases you heard about. Willie Tiffany, representing the League of Oregon Cities, described the Fish Passage Task Force, which actually was a process that went over two biennia. And Willie indicated that he believed long-term, in terms of cost savings for those efforts, could be in the billions of dollars. Now, obviously, not all of that is process and litigation costs. Much of the work with that Fish Passage Task Force was reconciling two competing sets of statutes. And actually, as folks begin to build projects that require passage, the results and ability to use mitigation and other means of meeting those passage requirements are where much of the cost savings occurs. You heard a little bit about the Conservation Incentives Work Group. Andrew Bowman from Defenders of Wildlife talked about and showed you a copy of the report that's coming back to this legislative session. And again, that likely will result in a couple of proposed bills. You heard a little bit about our success in resolving cases, and for the most part, some difficult cases that other traditional rights-based litigation and other methods were unable to resolve. Things like the 804 South Road case, which I know Senator George was involved in, really trying to work out some things. It took us about a year after we managed to convene that to actually get those folks together, and I think the agreement has pointed the way towards resolving this very difficult difficult dispute, probably a 20-year dispute along the Oregon coast. You heard from John Chandler, and I won't be able to be nearly as eloquent as he was, about the Neighborhood Streets Project, which again was a legislatively considered issue, and the fire districts and planning community managed to come together to resolve through a collaborative effort those issues. If you look on page 10 of the PowerPoint, it really talks about the goals of our agency. We were set up to meet the requirements or meet the needs addressed in ORS 183502, which in essence is to increase agency efficiency, decrease the cost of resolving disputes, and to increase the public and agency satisfaction with both the process and the results of dispute resolution. The kinds of things we do, if you look at the next PowerPoint slide, we've listed six of the things that are unique to the kinds of processes we convene. And really the top three of those are the things that set us apart and I think help us make these cases successful. The first two are case screening and case assessment. Case screening is an internal look with the agencies into whether or not a dispute resolution or a collaborative process would be appropriate given the agency's goals, given its mission, given its resources, those kinds of things. Case assessment is really looking externally, talking to the stakeholders, finding out what their interests are, looking at some of the alternative processes they could use, trying to figure out whether or not a collaborative approach is both the most efficient and has the best chance of success. And the third thing on the list is really helping parties find the correct mediator for the case. More often than not, the mediator selection part of the processes we convene is the first chance for these stakeholders to agree on anything. And we use the state's roster of mediators and facilitators, and that is something we've put together with the help of the Department of Justice, and work with parties really to find the right provider. Looking at just examples, again, sort of a summary slide on page 11, is really the kinds of cases we do can be divided into three primary categories. The first is really complex multi-party public policy controversies, things like the 804 South Road case. We recently helped the Department of Fish and Wildlife with its native fish policy, which, again, was an incredibly successful effort. It was 4 months of work and really brought people together that were having trouble agreeing on a policy. And from my understanding, the Fish and Wildlife Commission was able to work their way through that difficult set of issues really with the help of the process we were able to both financially support and help convene. Second are really legislative work groups and task forces. You've heard of a number of those examples. This biennium, the Conservation Incentives Group came out of House Bill 3564. That was a task force you set up. And then another one you heard John Chandler talk about a little bit is the Commercial Industrial Lands Task Force coming out of House Bill 3557. The third kinds of cases, really the Land Use Board of Appeals cases. Whenever an appeal is filed in a land use case, all of the parties to that appeal get notice of the availability of mediation assistance from our program. Just this morning on my voicemail was a call from a party in one of those cases asking us if we could look into whether or not mediation was feasible there. Probably one of the most interesting cases we've done out of the LUBA venue came out of Cook County. Actually, there were 8 separate appeals filed over one county action. We were able to get all those folks together in a single mediation proceeding, and although it took a while, they were ultimately able to reach agreement.
Can you tell me how the Dispute Resolution Commission in and of itself does that, though? My understanding is that while you may help coordinate some of those efforts, that's really done at the agency level. Can you explain to the committee really, I mean, I see most of your duties as a conduit to try and, you know,
get a second pair of eyes maybe on a dispute resolution piece. But all the agencies now pretty much have dispute resolution in process. Some of them have full-time dispute resolution people on board. I'm wondering what you do as a dispute resolution commission, you know, to... You can claim claim involvement, but what's the level of involvement? I know 50% of your funds go out in grants. What, 30% is more agency kind of related, and 20% is policy
or community. Only 20% is policy, so 30% is community DR support. So, you know, you're not actually the ones providing the on the ground dispute resolution services. You're basically a facilitator coordinator.
That's a great point, Chair Patridge. Actually, for the LUBA cases, we are the direct service provider. The initial point of contact comes through our program. And at least for the LUBA cases, we initially do work with the parties on doing the assessment and the screening, determining whether or not the case is appropriate, helping them, assuming it's appropriate, find grant funding or other sources that can support the mediator. Now, that's really where we cease to actually do the direct service in the case, and actually part of our principles here are bringing in outside of government, private sector neutrals for many of these cases. So at least in LUBA's instance, we are the initial point of contact. We do coordinate that work. Relative to agencies, I'd say it varies. Some agencies, if you look at the farm mediation program at the Department of Agriculture, Brent Searle over there really runs that program. We are a source of support and assistance. Brent occasionally will call us. He'll have technical questions. He'll want to talk through issues. We certainly have the expertise and technical support for folks like Brent and other programs. On the complex cases and the legislative cases, again, we were the initial point of contact. Agencies did not have or do not have dispute resolution programs directly aimed at those kinds of policy issues. So they came to us to actually do the screening and the assessment. We were able in some of these cases to find grant funding to find a private sector neutral, again, help them. Once the case takes on...
We're able to find grant funding through whom?
Actually, there are several sources of grant funding. The Department of Transportation has some federal funding that comes through it. TCSP program that came, actually started two bienniums ago, kind of a pilot. A number of the transportation cases, like the access management work group that started actually...
Those are issues within state government that already have grants that are set aside. So you're just identifying other money within state government?
Not necessarily. I mean, we've got other... I mean, there's, for example, the U.S. Institute for Environmental Conflict Resolution that we work through that we bring monies in to help with projects that wouldn't otherwise be in the state.
And how much of that money got brought in?
And I don't know. We could be happy to check for
you. Or you can get
that
back with us on...
Okay.
Other than outside state money, I mean, other than state money, state or local money... What other monies have you been able to bring in?
Chair Patridge, in the public policy program, this biennium, there are at least two cases that received grants from the U.S. Institute. Those were both approximately $90,000 grants. One of them goes to the Willamette River Total Maximum Daily Load, the TMDL process that DEQ is involved in. We helped early on assessment work with that and convening and helped them lay the groundwork for that federal grant. Again, the ODOT TCSP money comes from FHWA. We've helped them. We are actually the grant manager for that grant program for them. So we provide both technical assistance and where we can, we help them find money to support these bigger cases where we simply don't have the resources.
We're going to have to wrap this up pretty quickly. I think that we're looking... A lot of your money comes through fees, it comes through the court fees, obviously. We're in a financial struggle right now, and so I guess my question to you is, what if the commission goes away? What happens if we put the commission on hiatus for a couple of years and use that money to keep the police training open or do some of those things? I mean, what do you...
what happens to the system. I mean, I think the Dispute Resolution Commission was formed prior to dispute resolution or ADR, alternative dispute resolution or whatever, becoming kind of an in vogue thing. Now they teach it at all law schools. Lawyers are pretty familiar with it. People outside are familiar with it. What happens if we suspend your commission and move forward?
Chair Patridge, committee members, again, Mike Niemeyer, just a short, quick answer here is, well, that's correct. I mean, I think it would be correct to say that ADR is part of the infrastructure within government now. We have agency ADR coordinators. What we tried to paint for you is a picture, though, that, I mean, there are literally tens of thousands of conflicts that government gets involved in. The ones that we're in, these agencies and agency ADR coordinators do a good job on a lot of these things. But what we're talking about in the cases that Dale has presented to you are ones that, and I think the testimony that we heard last week was to the effect that had we not been there, those would not have moved ahead. And we'd be happy to talk to you more about what our incremental contribution was. But the we have a very critical role on the front end of these processes to do screening to help agencies figure out whether a collaborative process is going to be useful or not. There's benefits there both for cases when we say don't do a collaborative process, it's going to be a waste of time, and those they don't waste that opportunity, as well as the ones that we help move them along the path to getting folks together to solve their problems collaboratively. But we're dealing with kind of the tip of the iceberg in terms of those cases that agencies don't have the capacity to deal with. And I'd be happy to talk to you more about kind of the cost benefits of that.
I'd like you to tell us what some of the cost benefits are in writing so we can get back to the committee. You know, I'm concerned, I guess I am somewhat concerned if we look at the salary range that are within what's being paid at the Dispute Resolution Commission. I think we don't have anyone here except one person who's paid really both. Well, I guess you have some other, I think I would imagine these are probably part-time positions, but you have one, two, three, four, five people that are paid over $36,000 a year and some that are much more highly paid than that to carry on the functions of basically coordinating what goes on within state government. So I know that you have a declining revenue stream. I know that we've got some real tight budget considerations to think about, but I want to go back and we're going to need to sit down and go over some of where we're at, the salary levels that people are at, and look at where we're going to go into the future on the Dispute Resolution Commission now that it's more embedded. So I'm looking at the last page, like second to last page or something like that on the book if people are wondering what I guess not on the salary schedule all the way in the back. So I guess that's my concern. I'd like to have that back in writing and we can continue to meet more. But, my concern is right now in the budgeting process, I don't know where we're at. So, questions for other members of the committee before we.
Not from
Senator
a question,
George.
but a request, and that would be Mike. If you could provide for the committee, it's been mentioned probably six or seven times, or maybe even more, the 804 resolution. I'd like to have a summary of where you think we ended up.
Okay.
Describing if you have something like that, describing what the initial problem was, who raised the issue, what the impact was, and what the final resolution was.
We'd be happy to get back to you on that.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mike, close the hearing on Senate Bill 5515 and close that public hearing. We're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 5049. House Bill 5049 is the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Diane Middle is here. Who is the director of DPSST? And Dan, I'm not sure how you want to proceed with the presentation. Doug has joined us. You want to start, Doug?
Yeah, I do.
Doug's going to start us off today. Pass this out before.
The usual memo is in front of you. outlining budget notes, e-board actions, the audits. I won't go through those except that the emergency board actions with this agency seem to have a continuing theme around the new facility, and they made multiple visits on that during the interim on a number of issues, and I'm sure when they talk about the facility, we'll get into that a little bit more about some of those issues and where things stand today. On the second page of the memo, the budget drivers. Again, these are just a few of the budget drivers in this agency. Number of law enforcement, other public safety staff requesting training, or their agencies requesting training. The Public Safety Memorial Fund is part of this agency. I'm sure you've been contacted on that and the funding level in there. So a budget driver for that program is the number of law enforortment deaths that where the families are requesting benefits through that program. And another issue or driver would be the resources available to other components of the public safety system that affect the number of staff that require training in this and certification from this agency. Major issues, again, as you go through this budget, to keep in mind, two revenue issues. This is there is no general fund directly in this agency, but two of its primary revenue sources are facing shortfalls of one kind or another. We've talked about the criminal fines and assessment and the fire insurance premium tax. CFAA is the major funding source for this agency, and if I'm not mistaken, they are the biggest user of CFAA in state government for their law enforcement training and also for the debt service for what has been spent on the new facility to this date. So that's a big issue that if we work through that, we'll have to work through that, and I will announce or let you know that Friday morning we brought it together, a group of people, to start working on getting a more up-to-date criminal fines and assessment estimate out there for you all to work with in, during the work session. The cuts are listed there for CFAA at the top of the third page. I won't go through that because I think Bill and the department will probably touch on that. The fire insurance premium tax, we've talked about that before. There is some a smaller amount of funding for fire training. And also there's the budget is dependent on $670,000 of fire insurance premium tax revenue where the source has yet to be defined. We talked about that with the fire marshal budget also. There are some bill drafts out there. I'm not sure if any of them have been actually officially drafted yet.
I'll speak to that.
Okay. And so Bill will touch on that. Number of trends, often conflicting, will affect the work of this agency in terms of workload. Budget reductions, both locally and state, will affect the number of prison and jail personnel that are trained by this agency, and the same will probably deal with law enforcement and fire. But at the same time, the number of retirements in this sector, any public sector areas looking at it, the increasing number of retirements due to the uncertainty in PERS. As new folks come on, that will probably mean more training needs for those newer folks coming on in those areas. Public Safety Memorial Fund, number five, I've mentioned. The new funding for that program has been eliminated, and then even some of the carry forward has been transferred to other programs, and it is unclear, depending on what, I mean, that program is based on how many people actually request the benefit. If a number of law enforcement employees are killed in their line of duty, this program has lots of demand. If there are few or none, there is a relatively small amount of demand for their benefits. One thing to keep in mind, the Public Safety Memorial Fund, is that there is a federal benefit available, I think around $260,000, could be off by a little bit, but it often takes up to a year to get that benefit. And one good thing about the state program is it's rather immediate. It's a matter of a short time period that it becomes available. So you'll need to weigh the pluses and minuses on the funding on that. And finally, there are a number of issues around the training facilities, including the certificates of participation schedules, the demands to add the length of training. Oregon has the shortest training of the basic law enforcement training program, 10 weeks compared to over 20-week average across the nation. And there is the issue around whether the state police training should be part of this new facility. I put together a worksheet or a table that just sort of lays out, and I'll pass that out, that lays out sort of the options. I don't want to go through this at some point in time. We'll probably want to do this in the work session, but I do need to bring forth, and Bill will elaborate on this, is that the governor's budget assumes no new debt service in 03-05 for the new facility. The governor has already taken a step that does add roughly $565,000 of debt service in 03-05, which is not in his budget, and depending on what his plans are next, could add up to another $1 million over that to stay on a schedule. And I try to outline some of those alternatives. We'll probably come back to this spreadsheet at some point in time, if not during work session, but it does lay out sort of the various alternatives and the various steps that are there. So with that, Mr. Chair, I am done.
There's about a $500,000 plus hole because of the COPs that went forward on this budget. In addition, I just wanted to share with the committee, I did have Diana participated in the, I asked for the pricing, which I will get to you, Doug, if we can give that tomorrow,
okay,
that Diane sent. You know, the single largest driver really in this budget is the training that's provided to local law enforcement jurisdictions. It's not a direction that I want to go in as the chair, but it is something I think that we need to explore in light of the budget situation in regard to who pays the cost of this training, local jurisdiction. There's a DEA experience that every time local law enforcement jurisdictions would go out, they'd go out and pass a levy and hire new police officers, but they wouldn't hire a new DEA. So consequently, our workload increased rather dramatically, and we're in the same situation with providing, with the state fully providing the basic police training at no cost. So it is not a direction that the chair is recommending, but it is something in light of the budget situation that we will continue to look at. And there's got to be, I mean, there's trade-offs that we're all looking to. I don't want to shift any additional burden on local government, but in addition, we all have to, we're in the boat together, unfortunately, on this thing, and we all have to make some tough decisions. So, Dan, you want to begin?
Sure. Chair Patridge, members of the committee, I'm Diane Middle, the Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. With me at the table is Bill McGee from Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. Representative Patridge, you asked at a meeting early on for us to address some of the, as you term them, symbolic issues, and I think in the intros already that have occurred, you've touched on what those are, and of course the big one probably is the facility and also the fire insurance premium tax and the issues on fire training. What I'd like to do is kind of take a stab at making sure we're all on about the same page with that. And then also today, because the chiefs of police have a conference that begins tomorrow, with your permission, I'd like them to be able to get in today as well. And
absolutely.
Then we'll hit into the details of the agency's budget. To kind of put things into perspective, in 1971 was when law enforcement began training out the Western Oregon University campus. At that particular time, we trained approximately 3,600 police officers. That's the constituent base that was there, and from that, we trained their particular officers. In the late 80s, early 90s, disciplines began to be added to that training function out there, and so we went from just training the police and the deputies to also picking up corrections and parole and probation. In the later years, we also picked up the telecommunicators and the emergency medical dispatchers, as well as then fire and private security. So today we're actually working with 33,000 constituents, which is a big contrast from the 3,600 when that facility was first designed. What happened primarily is that staffing and the space did not keep pace with the responsibilities as they came on. And for a while that was okay, but then it reached its breaking point. And in about 1997, the agency itself was in crisis. And that was the point in time when there was a study done of the agency and a review done of the agency, and a number of things were recommended. And among that was that the department be created so that it was no longer attempting to function under a board, which had also grown from, I believe, 7 members all the way up to 23 members. All volunteers representing the basic disciplines that were now being trained and certified. There were a number of things that came out of that report which are significant and have played in my decision-making as I have brought forth recommendations in these difficult times. And one of those things was the lack of oversight, and so I've been very cautious that we not get back to the point in time where our management span of control is so large that we have difficulties with the large numbers of trainers and instructors that we use. The way we train is very unique in that we use agency part-time trainers, as we refer to them, which come from, they are full-time officers working in their particular disciplines, and they are the ones who come and teach at the program. So calendaring and scheduling is a challenge. Also making sure that they are teaching the appropriate curriculum and the current curriculum is always a challenge for us. So those are some of the things that we've been watching very carefully. At that particular time in 97, we were at 8 weeks, and we were experiencing 8 weeks of basic police training, and we were experiencing a significant backlog. We could not get all the officers trained that were needing to be trained, that were being hired. And so what we did initially was take care of that backlog and then begin reorganizing the agency and then beginning to look at how do we increase the training. In 1997, the legislature also said, in agreement with the public safety agencies that had come to speak to you, that we were so far behind in training that not only did we need to catch up the backlog, but we needed to advance it and we needed to get to 16 weeks of basic police training. That was the national average back in 1997. We've been able to get to 10 weeks of basic police training, and we've done that by basically doing swing shifts, working officers into the evenings, rotating their schedules. One of the things we do have to be conscious of is their overtime. They are being paid by their local agencies while they're there being trained, and their various union contracts do require overtime typically after 8 hours in a day. So with that, we've been able to maximize the space of the agency and the time that we have available, but it gets us to 10 weeks, which, without too much math, lets you know we're 6 weeks behind where we should be. What we also attempted to do was get to, as was requested, a scenario-based training. And what that is about is getting officers into as real a situation as you possibly can. The classroom way of studying just really doesn't work in a field where it's an applied skill. And so beyond learning the basic law, we had to get them to the point where they could actually do the skills that they were being asked to do. And so it meant not doing everything through book learning. We worked with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. We worked with Boston. We worked with a number of places that were doing very progressive training and were doing adult scenario-based training to figure out how it happened. From that, we created what's called a 7-theme scenario-based enhanced training. Where that comes from is it's a study that was done of everything that the community expects of their officers and everything the officers expect of themselves, and it's blended so that they understand those components in all of their decision-making. For example, they learn law. Not only do they learn law, but they learn diversity. They learn ethics. They learn their survival skills. They learn communication skills. They learn health and fitness, not only their own, but issues of health in their communities. I think I'm missing one, community policing and problem solving. And so all of those are combined into their decision-making process and into the training and in the scenarios. The challenge that we have is not only do we not have enough time to get this accomplished, but we don't have the facilities that allow us to do that. We can do tabletop exercises, but again, they aren't physically getting up and doing the things they need to be able to do. That's what prompted the legislature in 99 to ask us to begin looking at the feasibility of creating another facility and finding out where it would be, what it would look like, and we were given very strict marching orders that needed to be minimally adequate. The result of that study is what got us to the e-board in October of 2002, and at that point in time, we were authorized to go forward with a project, the total project cost being approximately $77.8 million, which would have been a debt service in this biennium of about $7.8 million. Obviously, with the things the way they're going with the economy, we were asked to take yet another look at that. And so with the governor's office, and I'm sure Bill McGee will talk more about this, we presented different options as to how we could reduce that debt service in this biennium and still keep the project moving forward. We did come up with an option for how we would do that, and the debt service would be approximately $1.6 million. But I think the question really gets back as to why is this so important and why should we keep moving forward in this? I think if you compare it to other disciplines and other fields, this is the only field, I think, where there's probably as much disparity between the amount of power that people are given, the choices they make, and the amount of training they get before they exercise that power. If you look at a lawyer, and in many ways an officer has to function like a lawyer and understand the law, a lawyer, even though they have many years of study before they go out and practice the law, they rarely have to make a split-second decision. If they have confusion over the law, they'll go research it, and then they'll come back with the answer. And now Representative Patrick has been in court, and he knows that we make pretty fast decisions in court, but not as fast and not as life-threatening as an officer has to make. You look at a doctor, even in the emergency room, where they may make life and death decisions, but they rarely have to make the decision to take a life. They rarely have to make that decision to take a life in a matter of seconds or under seconds. And they rarely have to make that decision in the darkness, in the rain, with a lot of confusion going on, and without sometimes any additional help or any kind of backup. I think we have sometimes a certain expectation of what people know when they're doing a job. I know, for example, if I call the gas company out, I sure assume that the person who's about to start the gas up in my house has done that before, that they know what the outcome is going to be as they light the pilot lights and set the pressure and those kinds of things. And I think that's where we're missing in our training with the officers, is that we and the community have an expectation that they have done these things before, that they have practiced them, that they know what the response is going to be to any given act. And unfortunately, that's just really not the case. Let me give you a couple of examples of why it's not working right now and why it's not working in the facility that we're in. When an officer studies now a building search, they'll, of course, get the law about when you can search and how you can search and what you can take and how you do an affidavit and those kind of things. But the only opportunity they have to practice that are in the stairwells, typically around the dormitory or in other parts of the building. You might say a stairwell is a stairwell. But on the other hand, what happens to them is they'll be in the middle of a scenario where they've been told they're in a warehouse or they're doing whatever, and the next thing they know, there's a change of class or staff is coming by. They're drawing down on something or looking around corners. Well, their entire concentration is broken. In real life, they would never, ever let anybody get up behind them, walk past them, go through those kinds of things. So it becomes very unrealistic. And the worst part is we're sort of teaching them bad behaviors, because we're telling them, ignore those extraneous things that are happening around you. Let them pass through. Let them do those kinds of things. Instead of stopping them, saying, I'm sorry, you can't go any farther. We have control of this scene. But we don't let them do that. So it becomes a very unreal situation and in some ways a very unsafe way for us to train. Another example is patrol procedures. That's probably the mainstay of many officers. Can they make the observations? Can they see what is wrong? Currently, we have absolutely no place or nowhere that they ever learn patrol procedures other than 7 hours in the classroom. They don't have a neighborhood where they go through and look through things or check things out or those kinds of things. When they do practice some of the areas, it's when they're doing traffic stops, and they do that in a state park or a wildlife refuge, which there are often, these are open to the public, and of course we can't close them down. We put up signs, training in session. I will tell you, we've scared more than one person as they come in and see officers drawing down on each other and wonder what's going on. But beyond that, we have situations where because there's so many of them trying to do the same thing in the same area, they can't learn the proper skills. They know about triangulation. They know about where the officers should be standing in relation to the suspect. But because there's so many of them, you lose what that means to them. You lose the safety mechanism that's a part of that. And it's even worse when they're sitting there trying to do these things. People come into the state park. They let their dogs loose. The officer's in a tense situation. He's got a dog jumping up and down on him looking for pets or whatever. And these things happen more often than not, unfortunately. Another area that is incredibly lacking is investigations. Typically, the officer will get a chance to do one scenario. We have two typically going on. One is we refer to as Buster's Bar, and the other one is a hotel room where there's a domestic scene going on. These are only divided by a curtain. So what you have is a bar scene going on in domestic, and the officers have got to sort out in their mind which one they're actually dealing with, because they're both going on at the same time with a different group of officers responding. And that's so we can get enough people through these scenarios to at least have a chance to try and do them. What happens is you'll send four officers in to do this investigation. The reality is most of these officers will work alone. They won't have four people. Portland might send four people to a call, but that's one of the few places that has that luxury. And so you'll have four officers, and maybe you have only three role players. That means they never get to do the interview. They only watch it. And if they make a mistake, there is no time to go back in and repair it and do it right. They just have to see, and then they get debriefed. One of the areas that is of great concern to me, just because I spent so much time prosecuting child abuse cases, is that they get 8 hours of lecture on how to deal with a child abuse investigation. That's it. They never talk to a child. They never work with it. They never even get the chance to have that conversation with each other, pretending they're a child, to see if they can coax out what it is they want from this child without contaminating the case. The risk there is additional trauma to the child, and I worry about that, because we try to train our officers to diminish the trauma on the community, but yet even in the best of intentions, when they haven't had the right training and don't know it, they can't get there.
Senator Devlin.
What extent, I'm trying to understand this from the standpoint of, well, it's been a long time, but do we have a lot of officers that are going directly from training to the field without being in a very supervised probationary period? Because a lot of departments that I've seen in the past have very extensive supervision programs for new officers, for these very reasons you describe, so that there's actually somebody basically keeping track of them in the field and exposing them to these things and training them while they're in the field.
Representative Patrick, Senator Devlin, there is a field training program that goes on after basic training, but most of the agencies, just the same as the state, do not have the way to train them other than they are with them and going through it in real life. So what they're doing is responding to calls with a coach. But there are also agencies who don't have that luxury, and they do actually go out and begin working on their own as soon as they left the training facility. The problem when you're learning working with a coach is you don't have the opportunity to do a replay or try to get it right the second time. You have to hope you did it right. And that's what we're trying to get away from. That's where the high liability area is. I can give you a really good example of that, and you may have heard or read the comment on it. I think just a week ago was in the Statesman Journal, and the reporter had been out kind of asking this question, why is the training so important? Why is having the facility in the right area so important? And this happened to be a corrections officer that he was talking to. And she had just finished doing a scenario in the gym dealing with an uncooperative inmate. The scenario didn't go very well, and so the trainers broke off, and they stopped, and they talked with her, and then she went in and gave it another try. And her comment to the reporter was, "I was sure glad I had a second chance." She wasn't going to get that in the real world, and what's sad about that is she may have fixed it there, but because we don't have enough time, she wasn't going to get to practice it several times to gain a confidence level that she would be set to handle that. And you're right, there is supervision, but it's a pretty risky business, and especially as budgets are being cut, there are more and more officers responding by themselves to calls much earlier in their career than they might have on another time. The other area that I kind of wanted to talk about, too, was in our confrontational simulations and defensive tactics. In this particular area, again, they basically get a chance to try it twice. And this is an area where they are put in a quasi-realistic situation. Most of these happen in a gym setting with an officer in protective or an instructor in protective clothing, and then the students responding to whatever their actions are in the scenario that it's been explained to them. Again, they basically get two chances to figure out a life and death decision. What happens is because we It takes a fair amount of time to get them through. When you have a class of 40, when they get into this kind of an area, we break the classes in half into 20. What that means, because we have no second place to go on the facility, is half of the class gets transported out to the Dallas Armory or to the fairgrounds or wherever. All of that time that's used for transporting is coming off of training time, because they're on the clock while we're working. So even though, you know, we're trying to accomplish 400 hours at our 10-week academy, it's really less than that, because they have to travel to do most of the skills. When they break up and use the two different facilities, as I indicated, when they go to the firearms range, that's out at Camp Adair. When they use the emergency vehicle operation course, that's over in Corvallis. And as I indicated, the traffic stops, all those kinds of things are at Hemlock and E.E. Wilson State Park. So we spend a lot of time moving people and equipment to other locations, which could be training time. I think what's of concern to me, and I'm sure to the state as a whole, is not only is there a risk to the officer and to their safety when they're not trained well, but I think there's also the risk to the community that things will not be handled well and it won't go well. One of the real basic instincts I think that we all have is when we're in trouble, it's a fight or flight mechanism. What we have to train out of officers is that natural instinct. Because, number one, we don't want them running away. They need to handle the situation. But, number two, we don't want them going to the farthest extreme, which is total flight. They have to learn everything in between. And to do that takes time. It takes practice. It takes repetitive practice so that they are training themselves to compensate for the physiological changes that go on in your body when you're under stress. For example, even if you're driving a vehicle under stress, what happens in a pursuit is you go into like a tunnel vision because you're watching everything that's right ahead of you, and it's very, very difficult to expand that unless you can control your breathing, control your thinking, and get yourself calmed down. Most people don't have that naturally. They have to learn it. They have to be trained in it. At our emergency vehicle operation course, we basically have an abandoned runway that's just a straight runway, kind of a strange surface on it. We set up cones. We do some other things, but it's not very realistic to what would happen in their communities with buildings, with people, with cars, with distractors, and all those kinds of things, beyond which they really can't go much above 50 miles an hour because of the surface that's there. It would be too dangerous. It's not a regular roadway kind of surface. So that limits it. And on top of that, when we go to Camp Adair for the firearms, it's a 1950s FBI straight lane kind of range, and you really don't have the ability to do anything off at angles because it was not designed to do that. The reason I talk about those things is those are the things that increase the liability to the state when we're not doing it right. The U.S. Supreme Court has already said that we are susceptible to a 1983 constitutional violation when we make deliberate decisions not to train, especially when we make decisions not to train in those high-risk areas that we know the consequences are grave when we don't train. And that's one of the reasons I feel that we need to think long and hard about how do we get, you know, at a bare minimum to 16 weeks. And as Doug indicated, you know, the rest of the country is at 22. But to get to 16 weeks...
Who pays for the rest of that training? Do all states pay the full training costs of the officers to get to the 22 weeks?
Representative Patridge, I'm not sure how all states work it. I know at least the ones I'm most closely familiar with, the state pays for the training. Most of them have a similar arrangement that we do where the agencies cover their salaries and benefits. But beyond that, I don't know. Some agencies, as you know, in some states, the agencies are big enough that they have their own, so it's much like our state police and some of the larger. California has
something
like
that. I'm
interested,
if we're being compared to the standard, what other states do in terms of their ability to pay for that training, if that's a fair comparison or not.
Let's see if I can find that out quickly.
Okay, thanks.
For you.
Mr. Chairman, can I add another question?
Senator George.
Diane, I'd be kind of curious as to what other things they may be doing that are a different kind of training. I don't want to go back to the scene in Men in Black, you know, when we're shooting the critters out there. But, you know, there's so many technology issues, and when you were mentioning taking people on the bus and going somewhere, I mean, if you're on a tour or if you're running a joy bus program at the local church, you know, you're teaching during the period of time that that's going on. And everyone's used to that. I mean, you sit in the bus and you're not looking out the window because you're not on a scenic tour. You're here to listen. It's actually a pretty good captive audience because they're looking forward anyway, and there you are sitting, standing there talking. I mean, why aren't we thinking about things like that? And do other states do that sort of, that different kind of training using technology?
Chair Patrick, Senator George, actually, while they're traveling to and from, they are getting instructions. Safety protocols and all those things are being addressed before they get there, and that kind of thing. And we are trying to use technology. In fact, we had brought on, referred to it as a distance learning, but technology-based learning to try and actually get so some of the scenarios can be a visual and canned rather than bringing role players in. Unfortunately, that's one of the positions that's been eliminated, so we're kind of going backwards there. Some of the other technology that I know that other states have gone to is some of the things that are now available in terms of less lethal force. It is still lethal, but it is less apt to be lethal than straight firearms. We don't do anything of that at all, so we have taken out of that force continuum a whole option that is now available through technology. We have used technology wherever we can in our learning to try and make it more efficient. We have developed a number of programs. You might recall last session there was a bill that required all officers in the state to be certified in speed measuring devices before they could issue traffic tickets. Well, rather than trying to bring everyone in for training, we created a CD-ROM that got that out to everybody. We do the same kind of thing for roll call presentations when there's a legislative change in the laws. Typically, at the end of the session, ourselves and state police and the DAs all get together and present one in video and get it out that way. So we are using those technologies wherever we can, but there's still an awful lot we can't get to. In the course of looking at what the facility needed, several of us, several sheriffs and chiefs and other folks went and looked at a lot of other facilities to see what they were doing, what were they not using that they had built, you know, those kinds of things, and what were they wishing they had, and talked to them a lot about those kinds of things. And everything we tried to put into this facility, we tried to look at it with an eye towards being able to do multiple functions so that, number one, it wasn't going to be obsolete over time, and number two, it wasn't just for the police, it wasn't just for the fire, it wasn't just, because there was no reason why most of these things wouldn't serve many, many functions. And that's what we did, and that's one of the reasons we were able to get the price as low as it is, which I know does not seem low at the moment, but in comparison to others, in fact, the closest comparison, we'll probably talk about this later today or tomorrow, is with Georgia. And if we looked at their, they're the only other place that has all their disciplines trained at one location. And they're on just shy of 1,000 acres, I believe. We're looking at 213. And I think they were like $140 million or something in today's price to do what they had. Now, we have a lot less than what they have, but the same kind of functions are being accomplished, and that's what we tried to do with this, is create a safe environment, but one that was flexible enough that you were only limited by your imagination on how you would create incidents and get training done. My own feeling is if we train right, if we use the technology, and if we're using our resources wisely and getting the whole spectrum of training, there are shootings or things that would have been shootings in the past that probably in the future would not be. I think that in and of itself is such a huge savings and such a huge factor that we need to keep that in focus as we look at the funding that's here. The impact on the rest of the system, I'm sure Representative Patridge knows this, but the better an officer does at interviewing and report writing, the better your chances are that you don't have to take a case to trial, and it saves a lot of money, it saves a lot of grief for people, it saves a lot of aggravation, beyond which the better trained they are, the better the decisions they make, the better they communicate with their community, the better able they are to blend over time with changing factors. Pretty much everything I've talked about has had a lot to do with police, and that's because that's the driving force. It's the need to get to 16 weeks for law enforcement. But just briefly, I think for the fire, it's much the same, but the issue, of course, as Doug Wilson indicated, is the fire insurance premium tax. We've had a problem with that for a while, and it was having shortfalls, and we had begun reducing our training in that area as well. I think with 9/11 and then with the economy, what happened is the impact appears to be just absolutely devastating on the fire insurance premium tax. Because of the way the law is written, it in many ways acts as almost the default insurance policy for companies who have gone out of business. And so, therefore, what would have been training dollars are now going to another purpose. And so unless we find a solution there, we're going to have the same kind of issues. We approach fire training a little differently because 80% of the firefighters in Oregon, of some 11,000 firefighters, are actually volunteers, which means we need to take the training out to them, be able to do it on weekends, be able to do it in the evenings and those kinds of things. The facility, however, has been designed to be able to allow fire training or some forms of fire training, and there were a number of reasons for that. Probably the two most significant is the fact that there really is no place where you can take this large fire equipment now and actually drive it in an emergency-type setting other than on your city streets. The type of machinery that they have now is it's more complex, it's heavier, it has more power than it's ever had before, and probably on your city streets is not the first place you want someone driving that equipment, especially if it's fully loaded or has water in it, which, as you can imagine, the weight can shift. The other thing we wanted to make sure could happen is that the police and fire could actually train together. That they would be able to do incident scenarios and be able to understand how each other works. That's something we can't do right now. There's no way that we can do that in any place. I think that's pretty much the areas that I wanted to talk about. The only other area that was in corrections, just kind of as a sidelight, is
before you go on, Senator George had a question.
Oh, sorry.
Diane, is it required that a person driving a fire truck have a CDL?
Representative Patterson, Senator George, I don't believe it is, if you can imagine that. But it's my understanding that it's not required.
Is that?
That's correct. Okay. The last issue is just kind of another pictorial for you in your minds, is that for corrections, we really don't have a place for them to train. They have to imagine the bars, the cells, and they have to pretend they're in a confined space when they're in the gyms trying to work with an offender. In an effort to try and give them a little more reality, we took a corner of the basement and we built out of plastic PVC pipe a little bit of a cell. That works okay for doing searches of a cell and those kind of things, but obviously you can't do a cell extraction or anything or you'd break the bars. But those are the kinds of things that seem so fundamental, but yet we're lacking and just can't get accomplished. I guess at this point, and in the interest of time, which I don't have a clock on, maybe if I could have the Chiefs Association come forward and make their comments.
We'd be happy to have the Chiefs come forward. If Kevin wants to come forward and introduce two Chiefs, that would be great.
Thank you,
Chief, today, Marla.
The DA last week, I might as well be a chief this week.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm here to introduce a few folks, and there's actually, I'm bringing apologies from Chief Walt Myers. He's a Salem police chief, and he got stuck in arbitration that he was required in today, so he was not free to be here, and he will not be attending our conference tomorrow. He continues to be involved in that. We'll try to come over tomorrow to be with the committee. I say executive director of the association because, as you know me, in my life as a lobbyist, but I also spend a good deal of time as the executive director for this association. I've had a wonderful time with a group of law enforcement professionals that really do take their work in law enforcement seriously, and we'll be in Corvallis the next few days, appropriate, I guess, on Beaver Day, for a conference. And when I started with the association in 1995, the issue I was most surprised about is what is passionately discussed. And the issue that is passionately discussed among chiefs of police is training. Doesn't sound sexy, but it is sexy in that environment, and we have a lot of heated, important discussions regarding training. Before I introduce Chief Rob Dupree from Astoria, one of the things that our association has undertaken in the last couple of years is what's called the Oregon Accreditation Alliance. And the chief sitting next to me was on a national accreditation board for law enforcement called CALEA. We've started one in Oregon because we feel like it's very important for us to establish in law enforcement agencies policies that reflect the case law that exists in law enforcement as we apply the law. And we've gone to great extents now to bring agencies into compliance and to bring policies on board. That's important because it reduces liability, and because of that, some of the folks like City County Insurance that insure our law enforcement officers are helping to pay for it because they think it's so important that we have these policies. The flip side of that, of course, is training, what we're here to talk about today. Training is what gives us the ability to actually apply the law without prejudice, to apply it intelligently and with respect to the policies of this state, laws of the state, and the policies that are established for law enforcement. So what I like to do, I've got two individuals with me today who are here for two different purposes. First, I want to introduce Marla Ray, who really doesn't need an introduction, and she really is a chief. But she actually traveled with our association several years ago for the purpose of creating a consensus around the issue of training. She has some of the issue, the kind of the history with regards to where we are, not just the Chiefs Association, but the Sheriff's Association. And then Chief Rob Dupree from the Astoria Police Department will speak on behalf of the association, then in terms of his feelings regarding DPSST and the training we received there and the importance of the budget. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Marla Ray.
Chair Patridge, members of the committee, Marla Ray, this is a little bit like deja vu all over again. We had, back in 1997, Director Middle made reference to an agency that was in substantial transition following an inquiry that was governor-ordered along with retired FBI Special Agent in Charge Lee Teetsworth. I assisted with that. How far the agency has come today from where we were back a few years ago and pre Ms. Middle is nothing short of remarkable, and I think that's an important perspective for you all to keep in mind as you struggle with the issues and the funding decisions that are before you in this particular budget. Back in 1998 and 99, the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police showed some tremendous leadership in trying to forge consensus among law enforcement agencies over the issue of training. You'll get into those as you consider DPSST's budget, but I've been asked by Kevin to highlight the results of that project that occurred just a few short now, 5-6 years ago. No consensus, none whatsoever, existed among law enforcement at the local level about the direction of training within the state of Oregon. I received shortly after Kevin's executive committee retained me to undertake this project an email from a longtime chief of police who served on what was then BPST, who said regional training, regional academies, and open enrollment have been discussed more times in the past 20 years than all of the rest of statewide law enforcement issues put together. So for some of us, this is, in fact, deja vu all over again as you take up a lot of the questions and the issues that face police training in Oregon. Beyond the police training, obviously, Diane has told you about the expansive constituencies that now are involved. We, in 1998, surveyed all then 181 local police agencies in Oregon. We had an astounding response of 132, given the number of people that, and it was a lengthy survey, so we were pleased at the return rate of that. After we got those results and compiled those, it was pretty apparent that there still wasn't any consensus about where we were headed with police training. We hit the road and over the course of 3 months conducted 9 regional meetings throughout the state, literally in every corner of the state, focused really on 6 issues. Those concerned whether we had centralized or regional training, whether DPSST was the sole provider of training or sole certifier or what its role in life should be, whether we should authorize local agency academies, the roles and relationships with community colleges and universities, and what's become known as self-sponsorship, where you can enroll in the academy and then go out and get a job. We actually did make some headway in reaching consensus throughout the state, and again, this was focused on the police side, not the other disciplines that are now out at the academy. And the primary results of that really get us to where we are today. The two chief punchlines were the need to establish and reestablish and substantially enhance communications between local law enforcement and the academy staff. Prior to that, we were probably at rock bottom for a variety of reasons, but that became a primary motive not only for Kevin's association, but also the sheriff's, as well as Ms. Middle and her entire staff at DPSST. The second primary outcome of that was the focus on a core facility that would have intimate involvement by local law enforcement agencies in the planning for such a facility. So, again, that was 1998-99, and that really takes us to where we are today and the issues that you're facing before your subcommittee. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions and turn it over to Chief Dupree.
Thank you. Questions for Marla?
Chief, welcome. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rob Dupree. I'm the Chief Police in Astoria. Thank you for the opportunity, providing the opportunity for me to come and give you some thoughts on police training. I suppose I ought to tell you you have a handout. Oh, you're about to get a handout, and I'm not going to reiterate the handout. I'm just going to tell you a couple of stories that elaborate a bit on the points that I've tried to make there. I should begin, I suppose, just so I'm not just some guy sitting here in a blue suit, tell you I've been the Astoria chief for 10 years. Before that, I was the chief of Springfield for 10 years. Before that, I was a real policeman in Arvada, Colorado, a Denver suburb, for 14 years. And I have a master's degree in criminal justice administration. I teach law enforcement topics at our local community college. So my comments to you are really going to come from that sort of a background. I became a police officer in 1970 in a major suburb of Denver, Colorado. It's about as a little bigger than Springfield is now when I started. It's a little bigger than Eugene is now. My first week, I got a uniform, a badge, a hat that I had to wear all the time, an equipment belt, and I bought my own revolver and my nightstick. I went up to the range to make sure I could shoot my gun, and I drove the police car around, and that was the end of the first week. The second week, I went to work. On Tuesday of that week, I was charged with providing police services at a major festival in this community. And so I was there wearing my hat and hoping that nothing would happen because I really didn't have a clue what I was supposed to do. A senior officer, and everybody was senior to me, came up to me, and it was about 10 o'clock in the evening, and said, "See that group of guys over there, the group of young men? See the guy in the blue jacket? Well, he's going to instigate a fight amongst some of these other guys. So if I go forward, I want you to go forward and get behind that guy in the blue jacket and hit him in the back of the legs with your nightstick as hard as you can." So I said, "Fine, it sounds good to me." And so I watched, and the guy with the blue coat walked away from the group, and he was in view, but he was doing something else. Nothing happened. Fortunately, the other officer didn't go forward, and I've wondered to this day if indeed he had, if I would have whacked that guy in the blue coat, probably I would have. And I was not a naive young person at the time. I had a bachelor's degree. I'd worked for Georgia Pacific selling lumber for a year. I was an Army officer. I took advantage of the Army's all expense paid tour of Southeast Asia. I got shot at and missed, shot at and hit. I've dealt with crises, and yet I didn't know what to do in that situation because I didn't have any training. Time went on, and I got most of my training from a police sergeant that taught me how he did the job. That was his job, was to train me, if you will. He was our training officer. And he taught me some good things, and he taught me some bad things. And I learned the bad things mostly by what happened when I did it. I remember stopping a drunk driver and a guy littler than me who just beat the hell out of me because I didn't quite have good training in how to make a traffic stop at the time. So after shedding some blood and some clothing and that kind of stuff, I kind of grasped how law enforcement was done. And in the first 2 years, I got 6 weeks of training from another agency. And while they had to untrain a little bit of that because my agency didn't allow us to pull people out of cars after pursuits and stretch them across the trunk and beat on them a little bit, and this other agency did allow that, that's sort of how we proceeded. And, you know, it worked there because of a couple of things. One is it wasn't 1978, so we didn't have Monell, and so government was not considered to be a person that could abuse its authority. Colorado had a very narrow window under which it could be sued. I didn't hear the term civil liability for the first 5 years I was a cop. We didn't worry much about that. Secondly was the law. I memorized all of the Colorado revised statutes that I needed to know. If the agency had a set of law books, I don't recall ever seeing it. I didn't get issued any. I just knew the ones I needed. Things have changed a bit. We have much more law than that today. Partly because we were changing from the due process, or from the crime control model of law enforcement to the due process model of law enforcement. So the people that were training me were much more interested in preventing crime than they were about dealing with those niceties of the Bill of Rights and defendants. And as we got further into that model, as we started getting more and more law, that caused us to start worrying about civil liability. And as the legislature continued to add to the number of laws that we got to deal with every year, things started changing. That kind of training, of course, wouldn't work today. And none of you would want that kind of training today. Today, for civil liability, I have to talk to an attorney every time I do a new project. I have to have an attorney approve any terminations that I do. I have to have a lawyer involved in most disciplinary things. We never did that. I mean, I saw a cop in 1973 fired in the middle of an intersection at midnight, and that was it. There was nothing more to that. Times have really changed, and our police training needs to get to keep up with that. Just looking at the kind of stuff that I had with the things that I've explained and the kind of things that officers deal with today with their personal equipment. I mean, you've seen cops out there and you've looked at their equipment belts. They even have, you know, personal computers hooked on them along with chemical stuff and expandable batons and all that kind of stuff. If you just look in the cars, when I became a police officer, my car was a kind of cool car. It was a Nash Rambler, actually, and it had a radio that didn't work all the time, but when it worked, it was okay, and I just talked to the dispatcher talked to me, and that's all we had to do, and it had a switch. The lights and siren were on, and the lights and siren were off. That was it. I didn't have a shotgun. We didn't have anything else. Today, if you look at just even in Astoria, as rural as we are, and we're certainly not big city, my cops have lights and sirens that can be adjusted for the environmental conditions. They have radar, laser, passive alcohol testing devices, video cameras, rifles, shotgun, less lethal shotguns that we hope we paint a different color so we don't get them mixed up with the real shotguns, radio that monitors 25 channels for local agencies. My dispatchers dispatch 17 other public safety agencies today. We got laptop computers. We're getting mobile data terminals in the cars, water rescue equipment, and defibrillators. I mean, just a night and day difference. And I think you probably know what I'm telling you, but I think maybe in the rush of all the stuff that's happening today, that might be overlooked. So my point in telling you this is, you know how things were then. Times have changed, and in order to keep up with the times, what we've tried to do with our officers is to provide more training. And if you want to keep the cost of the Police Memorial Fund down, then provide more officer training, because there's plenty of data out there that shows that the two cops a week that die on the job pretty much made a mistake. And if we can train them, we can't train them to avoid all mistakes, but if we can train them so that they can avoid most of the mistakes, we can keep them alive, we better protect our citizens. That's point number one. Point number two, and the last point, is the unitary assessment. You call it the criminal fines and assessments. My recollection is the unitary assessment was created to fund police training, period. We, the police, have a vested interest in the unitary assessment because it funds police training. When I was the chief in Springfield, we were going to have to lay off three officers. And instead of doing that, we talked the city and let's keep three officers for a year, and I created a traffic team that was designed to create enough new traffic revenue to be able to keep those officers. And we did. In fact, we made $100,000 the first year, and within 4 or 5 years, we were bringing in $600,000 a year in increased traffic revenue. Now, that was the worst political thing I could have done. Because statistically speaking, every man, woman, and child in Springfield would get a ticket every 3 years. I mean, we're Americans. We don't like traffic tickets, whether they're deserved or not. We don't like them. That was a very dumb political move on my part. But it did increase finances for the city. We did keep the officers, and there were a lot of operational needs for that. And we did add money to the unitary fund. About that same time, I remember talking with the director, former director of then BPSST, who told me that he wasn't allowed to spend all the money that he got from the unitary assessment because all of the departments in the state had to suffer the same percentage of budget cuts. So we had money there that could be used to increase our training, but we couldn't use the money to increase our training because general fund departments had to be cut. I still don't understand that. And it still doesn't sound like a good idea to me. But nevertheless, I think that the unitary assessment has been used for an awful lot of things other than the point that it was intended. That's fine. I mean, as long as the first thing that it was intended to be used for is what it's used for, and I think that is police training. We the police, do work very hard for that money. I mean, I don't know how many of you have made contact with someone to give them a traffic ticket when they deserved it, of course. But people don't like that. We work hard to get that money. You help us now. You definitely do, because you have created a number of laws that allow us to write traffic tickets without stretching our imagination at all. From not signaling for a turn within 100 feet of making it to the basic rule, which is still, I think, something in transition. We have plenty of reason to write traffic tickets that you've given to us, but we work hard to do that, and we would very much like to see that money used first for police training. I've been a cop for 32 years. I can go on and on and on, but I'll stop. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Questions for the chief?
Mr. Chair, I apologize for missing. However, I did catch a portion of Rob's description of his Nash Rambler and a single set of switches. It reminds me of my first calculator, which was most of the keys were all in Roman numerals.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
I think what I will try to accomplish next is kind of a quick agency overview, and then Bill McGee will kind of walk through some of the budget process, and then I can get into more detail in the program areas if you would like. In terms of the agency, I know you're aware that we are the department since 1997, the end of 97 when it was created. We do still work very closely with the board. As I mentioned earlier, the board is made up of 23 members. Each of them representing a different discipline or aspect of that discipline. We also, as of last session, have in statute and in operation 4 policy committees, and the policy committees represent the police, corrections, telecommunicators, and fire. And the reason for that is that because the board is so large, it was very difficult for the individual entities to wrestle with issues that were specific to them and come up with good policy decisions. So the policy committees were created to do the nitty-gritty work of wrestling with new ideas and new issues. For example, in the police area, they've been very concerned about maintenance training. As you know, most professions do have a level of continuing education that occurs, and for officers, it's very critical that they continue to train so that perishable skills do not diminish and so that they also learn the new things and advance their education things beyond basic. So that committee then works through what's reasonable, how many hours ought to be expected, that kind of thing, and then we'll make their recommendation to the board. Also, there are oftentimes when there are issues that are the same for all of the entities, and so they will work out what works for each of the particular disciplines, and then they will take that to the executive committee. And the executive committee is made of the chair of each of those policy committees, and that committee then will make sure that they haven't developed any inconsistencies or contradictions between the disciplines. Obviously, things are not identical between police and fire and corrections and parole and probation, those kinds of things, but nonetheless, they don't want to be in conflict, so they take care of that. In addition to the four policy committees, there are two advisory committees. One is for private security and one is for polygraph licensing. They have primarily the same functions as the policy committees. In fact, there's a bill this session that turns the private security committee, advisory committee, into a policy committee. The reason that is important is that for the board to overturn a final decision of a policy committee, it does take a two-thirds vote. So while they do offer oversight, once a decision has been made, it does take a concerted effort on the board to overrule that. In terms of the agency's budget, we basically have five budget units. The criminal justice unit handles training and certification for police, corrections, and parole and probation. Those come from the Criminal Fines and Assessment Public Safety Fund. The 911 training, emergency or telecommunicators, emergency medical dispatchers, is in that same funding unit. However, the funding comes from the excise tax. The second unit is the fire training and certification. As you know, that's funded by the fire insurance premium tax. Private security is a fee-based operation, so the advisory committee determines what the fees will be, how that's distributed amongst the industry, and they, in fact, in order to not experience shortfalls and to be able to continue the program at its current level and actually to encourage some more enforcement, which is what they're asking for, they have approved a fee increase for themselves, which will take effect on July 1. We then have the Public Safety Memorial Fund, which is a separate appropriation from the criminal fines and assessment account. And then the fifth unit is the major construction acquisition, which is funded through the COPs and through criminal fines and assessment public safety fund. I think I'll kind of skip going back over the program service areas at this point in time, but just to let you know, the agency administration includes within that not only the director's office, but also the human resource division, the information systems division, and the business services division are all rolled up. In addition, because we have different funding sources, we do prorate that across all those entities. It's paid directly out of CFAA, but then there's an intra fund transfer from each of the other funding sources for that. As you'll note on page 5, and I think it's been referenced at least in innuendos, is our business plan. We did develop that with a lot of help from all of our constituents. We, as Marla Ray indicated, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police made a tour of the state. We also, as an agency, very early on made a tour of the state to see if we could figure out what everyone wanted and how to move forward. And we're able to determine and have been working under this business plan since 1999. It has guided all of our decisions. We are now at the point where we are beginning to revise it. We have accomplished much of what is in there, but now we need to take another look at it as we move forward with the new facility and the role that regional training will have in the future. I think the major changes we've already talked about having to do with the increase in the constituents that we've had. I'm trying to hit the high points in here. I think probably just one area, and this might respond a little bit to Senator George's question about technology, is we have put a fair amount of technology in the classroom. We literally used to have blackboards and flip charts. We now have come into the room, the world of CD-ROM, and have laptops and presentations. We also have put in a bank of computers so that officers are now doing actual reports. We went from them doing typically one or two police reports in the time they were there, and they now accomplish 15 reports. So that's one of the areas that we've gotten lots of comments from their chiefs, that they see an officer much more able to write a decent report by the time they leave. I think that's probably the most significant parts in the overview before we get into details, so I'll turn it over to Bill at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Education Services. We're having the handout being distributed to you now. The governor's budget for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training is $20.9 million other funds and about $217,000 federal funds. The pie chart of page 3 shows you that that's primarily another fund budget, about 99%. As you've heard, the major funding sources here really are the criminal fines and assessment account and the fire insurance premium tax. Page 4, highlighting the governor's budget as it was originally developed. You've heard some changes since then, and I will speak in a moment. It is a 27.8% decrease from the 2001-03 legislative approved budget through the 5th special session. There were no significant changes that were made during the 5 special sessions in this other funds budget. The governor's original proposal reduced criminal justice program unit by 15 positions due to a shortfall in the fines and assessment account revenues. We talked about that previously when we did that CFA overview for you earlier in the session. Originally, the governor's budget did delay the construction of the new academy to avoid the $7.8 million in debt service. The fire program was reduced by one position due to the shortfall in the fire insurance premium tax we talked about during the state police budget. I'll review that again for a quick report today. It does assume, as Doug indicated, passage of legislation to remedy that fire insurance premium tax problem. The governor's budget allocates no new CFA revenues for the Public Safety Memorial Fund in 2003-05, and it does increase private security fees to maintain the current program level. There have been a number of developments since the governor's budget was released, and I'll spend some time going over those. You've heard, I think, most of this in one form or another either today or in earlier hearings. Probably the most significant is the construction project has been resumed. There was a sale of $5 million in certificates of participation in March 2003. As Doug indicated, that would obligate $564,000 in debt service in the 2003-05 biennium. Proposal is to issue another $68.2 million in COPs in the 2003-05 biennium. The estimated debt service next biennium for that amount in COPs would be about $1.1 million.
When do you want? When's the proposed issuance of those?
They're on a schedule that would be.
You have that later on your presentation, Bill.
Well, I can tell. I'm talking to you now. Let's see if I have that. Yeah, I do. In May 2004, there would be another $5 million issued. In October 2004, there would be.
That's the chart that Doug put out.
It's on there. You have the exact dates.
Yeah. Well, at least the tentative dates at the moment, assuming it's the sales occur as we envision now. But in May 2004, as I said, there would be another $5 million. In October 2004, another $20 million. In May 2005, another $43.24 million.
Okay.
And that would be the rest of the financing for the project.
Okay.
As I said, the debt service there would be about $1.1 million for those additional COPs. We're believing in order to continue the project, we need 3 positions that were eliminated in the original governor's budget. 2 of those are limited duration positions, the project director and an assistant, and also an accountant position that would be necessary to manage the accounting workload from continuing on with the project. Total, that would be about a $2.1 million adjustment to the governor's budget, including COP financing costs. We do not have a recommendation to you at this time on how the costs will be funded. The co-chairs are working the budget. The governor's working the budget. You basically have a number of different choices here. One is a general fund appropriation. Another is a shift of the split between the CFA dollars between the general fund and the public safety fund, and that's in essence a general fund appropriation. You know, the color of the money is different, but it's reducing the revenue in the general fund. You have the choice of looking in this budget and trying to find other reductions, or looking in other CFAA budgets and taking reductions, or some combination of the above. But as I said, at this point, we don't have a specific recommendation for you and what to do from there. Next issue, I think we talked about before, the CFAA forecast is down in March 2003. Judicial Department, we reduced their forecast by $10.9 million from December 2002. And if you assume the 70-30 split between the general fund and the public safety fund, that's $3.2 million or a 10.2% reduction in the public safety fund. Since in the governor's budget, DPSST gets about 48% of those CFAA dollars, you can see where a pro rata reduction would affect this budget. So there's another problem we need to work through as well as move forward with the budget. Next issue, since the governor's budget, again, the fire insurance premium tax, March 2003 forecast has been reduced. We talked about that last time we talked about that. It's down by about $409,000 or 10.9%. House Bill 3051 would allow insurance companies to recover the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association assessments through a premium surcharge. There are amendments to that bill that are under development. I understand that is expected to be the vehicle to deal with this. The governor has not endorsed a specific proposal other than to be supportive of the legislation that would remedy this problem. And the Public Safety Memorial Fund, the governor's office has convened a work group to identify options to continue benefits for defendants of officers killed or permanently disabled in the line of duty. We don't have a recommendation at this time on the funding for those, but I assume we will be back to you with a recommendation fairly shortly.
Mr. Chair, just a question about that.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really, as I read the mission, I'm not sure what the Public Safety Memorial Fund has to do with the mission of the agency, and I believe that's probably heresy for even asking. But I would like to know if the benefits that we're talking about for officers and dependents of those taken in the line of duty, if that's in addition, these funds are in addition to all of the workers' compensation and life insurance and the other benefits that these folks have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the short answer is yes. In the 1999 session, I think Representative Westland was the primary sponsor of legislation that established the fund located in DPSST. I think one of the major concerns is that while there are a number of benefits, including, as Doug indicated, about a $260,000 federal benefit, tuition benefits from both the U.S. Department of Justice and the Student Assistance Commission in the state, there is a gap in time between the author's death or permanent disability prior to that federal benefit of about a year. So there was a significant concern to be able to bridge that. The Public Safety Memorial Fund also provides some mortgage benefits, health and dental benefits as well that are not necessarily overlapping with any other benefit source. So there are a number of issues there. We're looking at trying to streamline those and come back to you with a proposal that would really primarily go to the federal benefit and really bridge the gap where other benefits don't provide coverage.
Mr. Chair, just to confirm, this is in addition to all other benefits, and this is all also to in addition to the two times the or 2% presently provided for the fire and police units which is about a 30% hike on all of the rest of the PERS benefits as well.
That's correct.
I guess one other contextual issue. When this fund was established in 1991, there was an increase in the unitary assessment. I forget whether it was $1 or $2, but was intended to be the funding source for this benefit.
Mr. Chair, do we provide our law enforcement and fire police units? Do those folks have any additional benefits as far as life insurance is concerned in some of the forces that they're signed on to?
Mr. Chair, I think we can get you a list of what the what all the benefits are. I don't have that
okay.
today.
But I appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the on the various ways to keep the facility capital construction online, is there any breakdown in terms of if we went ahead issuing the COPs, particularly with the governor's current plan, how much work that would generate and what the impact of that major of a construction project would have on the Glenel Fund? I know in transportation we talked about roughly 18 construction jobs for each $1 million of capital spending. And depending on how this is sequenced out, I'm wondering if there is general fund benefits to going ahead with issuing the COPs.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hansen, I think the department has some information here, and I'll turn it down here. But there would be some significant construction jobs that this would create, obviously. It's a major project at nearly $80 million, so there clearly would be a short-term impetus from the, putting those folks to work on a project of this size.
I know what happened. Thanks. Yeah, it's part of what I'm looking for.
Well, you're looking that up, Senator George?
Yeah, and it'll fit with that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're talking about a $78 million project. Has anybody calculated the actual maintenance cost necessary to maintain a facility? Because when it costs $78 million, believe me, you're talking about a major facility.
Here, Senator George, we do have some cost estimates for the operation facility. I'm not sure if we have that today or if we would be better off getting back to you tomorrow.
We could do it tomorrow, probably.
Tomorrow, if that would be okay.
That would be great. And they're consistent with the actual numbers that we're now having for buildings that we built that we're needing to maintain?
Mr. Senator George, this is a very unique facility for the city.
Right.
We don't have anything like this anywhere else, so I'm not sure that we'd be able to look to an office building and make anything that was comparable for you. We don't have that many firing ranges, and I don't think we have any other driving ranges, so... But we can present you what we do estimate.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Hansen's question.
Okay. The information that we received from the employment division, I was looking for a second sheet here too, but basically for every $1 million of annual expenditure, there's 18.3 jobs. So you were correct in your recollection that that's how that would work. This project would create approximately 231 direct jobs during its 2.5 years of construction. The 231 direct jobs will have a secondary benefit of creating an additional 298 indirect or induced jobs for a total of 529 jobs over the 2.5 years. For every dollar spent directly on the project, an additional 72 cents is spent in Oregon due to the purchase of goods and services through the indirect and induced linkages to the project. This means that $72.3 million Public Safety Academy, and that's when it was done a little bit earlier, so I have to fix the numbers here, but basically would support a total increase in Oregon sales of about $124.4 million over the 2.5-year construction period. And I thought I had some updated figures, too, but I'm not putting my hands on them right away. But it's close. It improved the figures just a little bit.
Well, why don't you get back to us with some written stuff on that, Diane, so we'll have it for the benefit of the rest of the members of the committee when you have the more detail.
Okay, Mr. Chair, proceeding, then on page 7, the pie chart there that shows you the distribution of the different program units in this budget. The Criminal Justice Standards and Training Unit is the largest, say about 87%, the Fire Standards and Training 7, Private Security 5, and the Public Safety Memorial Fund about 1%. Page 8 shows you the expenditure categories, personal services about 57%, services supplies 39%. Debt service, as we are now, not with the additional COPs that were issued in March, about 3%, and then special payments, which is just the Public Safety Memorial Fund, again, about 1%.
Thanks. Sir?
Where do port excursions come into this pie chart?
Those would... actually, we don't have any funds for capital outlay in the next budget, so the port excursions would not come into the budget.
Would
be true?
Well, we don't purchase them, we lease them.
Lease them, okay. Yeah, so they would be service supplies. Okay.
They're in the services and supplies.
They're in the supplies.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bill.
Sorry. Proceeding on page 9, then, just showing you the development of the budget. We started with legislatively adopted budget of about $25.6 million. The emergency board, through April, approved $3 million, other funds for facilities to design the site evaluation. Base budget adjustments, pretty standard. The position actions and compensation changes. The estimated cost of step increases. The debt service adjustment eliminated debt service. It was approved but never obligated us for, because we didn't issue anything other than one COP during this biennium prior to March, which won't accrue. Debt service won't accrue until next biennium. And then the capital construction that was approved as a one-time is eliminated. Essential packages, package 20, this is standard vacancy factor adjustment, package 30, inflation, state government service charge adjustments, again, small amounts there. Package 70, revenue reductions here, we talked about the impacts on the shortfalls of the criminal fines assessment account, the fire insurance premium tax revenues, and the private security fees. Before any restorations, that would have eliminated 26 criminal justice positions, two fire positions, and the private security positions. You will see in policy packages restoration of 12 criminal justice, one fire, and one private security position. Moving forward. The next page starts the policy option packages. Package 81, third special session, other funds were reduced by $11,000. This is the cost of living increase for salary range 38 and above was eliminated at that time. Program reductions, package 90, reduced $107,000. This was the reduction in the Public Safety Memorial Fund expenditure limitation, again, to avoid further reductions in criminal justice programs due to the shortfall in CFAA revenues, and shifted $61,000 from other services and supplies to professional services to eliminate a negative balance. It's a technical issue, really. Package 92, other reductions, was $290,000 other funds, one position, and eliminated one additional criminal justice position to maintain the CFAA split at 70-30%. Package 106, 911 program increase, $75,000 other funds. This increased funding for part-time instructors, classroom materials, and student housing costs for the telecommunications training program. As you recall, this agency is responsible for training telecommunicators and emergency medical dispatch personnel. And the revenue is available from the 911 telecommunication tax administrative allowance, which, as you recall, is about 4% allowance in that funding stream. So it's a transfer from Department of State Police. Package 107, position requests, $104,000 other funds, two positions. This continues a limited duration traffic safety coordinator that's funded by a federal grant that's transferred to the Department of Transportation. It establishes one permanent position to coordinate employee background investigations, replacing a limited duration position. We needed to establish a permanent one there. And establishes one permanent position for part-time legal instructors. To provide part of the funding for this, it eliminates a training position and reduces service and supplies to fund the investigator and the legal instructor position. So it's partially internally financed. Package 108 is the restoration of positions, $2.7 million other funds, and restores 12 of the 26 positions eliminated, packages 70 and 092. And it's funded with CFAA revenues available at that time due to the delay in the construction of the new academy. Package 201, the fire training backfill, $671,000 other funds. This restores one of the two positions eliminated, package 70. And this anticipates the legislative proposal to remedy the shortfall in the fire insurance premium tax and anticipates revenue for a $10 daily fee to be charged to fire departments or firefighters who attend classes of 8 hours or longer. That's a new fee proposal. Package 301, the private security fee increase, $176,000 other funds, restores one position that was eliminated in package 70, and it's funded with an increase of approximately 28% in various private security fees. This proposal was developed in conjunction with the industry, and it has their support as well. So the fee and revenue changes you have are the $10 fee for 8-hour firefighting classes. Those fees will be established administratively in the 2003-05 biennium and submitted to the legislature in 2005 for ratification according to that standard process. And the increase in private security fees, again, administrative increase in 2003-05 and submission to you in the 2005 session for ratification. The next several pages are just the Insurance Guarantee Association presentation I made to you when we looked at that in State Police, and I won't do that again unless the committee would like me to. And finally, on page 17, just shows we have no technical adjustments at this time.
Bill, questions? I'm looking at your budget book here.
I'm looking at under, so everyone knows, the special reports. We have those here. I'm looking at your licenses and fees piece. You have a $300,000 plus, $320,000 plus jump in your fees.
Mr. Chair, if we could bring Elaine Sears, who's the business manager for the agency, who's able to help with some of this stuff.
Where are you?
I'm behind the special reports tab.
This one. This will be the revenue section of the Orbitz report?
I hope so.
That's part of the Orbitz report.
Yeah.
I just want to get these in because we're going to.
Chair Patridge.
0205. I'm on page 1 of 13.
So we're at the fourth page
in.
Under special report, so you're okay with that.
So this would be, the numbers you'd be looking at would be.
0205, business licenses and fees. There's a jump from $1,025,000 in 0103 to $1.3 million.
Mr. Chair, I believe those would primarily be the private security fee increase.
Okay. If you can just get back to me on
sure.
To make sure that that's what that is.
That private, Mr. Chair, that private security piece is this $176,000, and it's the single single employee there that was reduced under package 070, and then it was fully restored under 301. Do we have nature and indication is that that's fully restored by 28% increase in various fees? I think Bill said as agreed amongst the parties. I'd like to know some more about that.
I think that's the Board of Investigators.
If I may, Representative Patridge and Representative Butler, the private security industry requested, I think, in 95 to be regulated, and as a part of the statute that created the private security unit as a way of regulating the industry, they also created an advisory committee that was made up of representatives of the different aspects of the industry, of the private security industry. So there's everything from hospital and hospitality security to retail security to all kinds of different types, and they're all represented in this committee. They together looked at what the increase would be necessary to maintain the program, and they determined as a group how to disperse that fee among their business interests, I guess, because what they didn't want to do was put the burden on the instructors that instruct for them, but they thought it was in their best interest to put a greater burden on the licensing for the executive managers. So they made the choice how to distribute the fee to get to the sum that they needed. And they worked on that over several months and came to agreement on it. And as far as I know, they do not have any dissension within the industry. They've all agreed that it's appropriate, and they wanted the program to continue. The only exception being is they're actually requesting more enforcement.
Senator George.
Well, my question is along the same area, and I'm looking on page 4 of the governor's budget presentation. It says, down at the bottom of that last bullet point, it says increase private security fees to maintain current program level. Were they not paying the total amount, or is it actually caused that much roll-up cost in going into the private security training program? Were they not paying the full amount? And relative to that, too, I mean, right now, are the only fees that are being paid? I see that $10 per day fee going to fire department folks. Or anybody? Is there anybody else paying fees except for the private security ones?
Okay. Okay. No, I think I'll let Elaine Sears address kind of where they were and being able to maintain, but I think that the answer to that question is we had figured out what the roll-up costs would be, what some of the government services charges were going to be, some of those things that were just natural increases, and we gave them an estimate of what that would be. So they had the choice, do you want us to reduce services or do you want to come up with this amount of money to maintain where we are, and they opted for that. The other question I think was, are there other fees? There are some minimal other fees. We occasionally get reimbursement for some regional training programs, I believe. There are also fees that come in from the polygraph examiners, I believe, and just some very minor miscellaneous fees that occasionally come in.
What I'd like to do in the interest of time is run through these because they're only going to be back tomorrow so they know what questions to ask. Then we can go into detail tomorrow if that's okay with the committee. I wanted to run through it. That's on the revenue side, and I don't know why we're creating that much additional revenue. But I'd like an explanation on that one. I'd like to go to page 8 of 13. Well, first I'd like to go to page 4 of 13. I am concerned about on line items 3160 on the temporary appointments and overtime payments. You've substantially cut those back in the upcoming biennium. Whether you're going to have the staff to be able to do that, I'd like you to briefly address how you're going to deal with those since you took such substantial hits on those things, if you can really maintain in light of what you put forward there. Other questions I had on page 8 of 13, on employee training, line item 4150 at the top of the page. Am I going too fast? I'm wondering what the employee training is going up by about $35,000 there. The next item down, 4175, the office expense piece, you had a legislatively adopted budget at 229, 248. You're doubling that and maintaining it into the next biennium, so I'm wondering what the shift is on office expenses on that category. On the state government service charges on that same page, item number 4225, I have some idea of what's in there. I'd just like a breakout of what those particular state government service charges are because that's a lot in state government service charges, so I don't know if that assumes new buildings or what. And the publicity and publications, that takes a $25,000 jump. I know it was much higher before, then you pared it way back. Now you're jumping it back up again, so I'm wondering where that is. And then I'm flipping over to page 10 of 13. On the expendable property, line item number 4700, you jump from 238,420 estimated this biennium up to 444,000. I'm wondering what's the rationale for that particular jump. From my perspective, the only other thing is back towards the back for committee members on the first page, the overall page of the PIC system, which is the computer printout, I'm also interested in. You have 10 principal managers for the department. I'm interested in where the principal managers fall in relationship to who they supervise. It seems like a lot of principal managers based upon the principal managers that we look at in other departments of staffing to staffing to principal manager ratio. So if you could let me know how the distribution works on those principal managers, I would appreciate it. Those are my questions.
They were mine too.
All right.
Can I do two quick comments, Mr. Chair? First is on the service supplies item. If you look at on page 10 of 13, if you look at the legislatively adopted budget versus the estimates versus the governor's balanced budget, you will see that we've gone down from the total service supplies. I'm at the very bottom of the page, from about $8.8 million down on the legislatively adopted 8.2 and the estimates 8.2 in the governor's budget. You've seen we have reduced those. A number of the ups and downs you're seeing in some senses are sort of truing up where the actual expenditures
and I understand
occur.
That. I just want to have a good understanding of what we're truing up.
Sure. And the other issue, just a quick one on the managers. One thing you don't necessarily always see in a lot of agencies you see in this one is the number of part-time instructors. There's 200 to 300 part-time instructors who also require some supervision, so you don't see that many positions out there because you may have 50 30, 40, 50 people all assigned to one single position, all working part-time, but those folks still require
I realize that. But I just want to have a...
We'll get you more detail.
...full and fair disclosure of those principles. Correct.
One other question, and I don't know if this is going to be available, but you've talked about two budget drivers. One, because of retirement, situations that we may get an increase in retirement, which would cause more replacement officers to be trained. And then the second factor is the downturn in the economy may cause other governments not to. How do you project out the number of people that are going to need training during the biennium, and what's that based on, and do you have your most current estimate?
Can we, why don't we lead off with that tomorrow, Diane? Representative Hansen's question. Anything further for them to bring back for tomorrow?
Chair, we do have another bill up at the beginning of the time tomorrow. That's the Child Support Enforcement Transfer Bill. We need to get that moving in the process. It has to be completed through and signed by the governor by about the 1st of May. So we'll start off with that bill, and Attorney General will be here, and some from DHS.
So we're gonna work on that. We have a really packed schedule this week, so if people could try and be here on time at 1 o'clock tomorrow, including the chair, we will get it done. Thank you. We're going to continue over the House Bill.
5049.
House Bill 5049 for the for tomorrow's committee. And with that, we are adjourned.